It's Monday, April 29th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. A few days ago, a dolphin showed up dead on a Louisiana beach. Foul play was more than suspected.
Now to Cameron Parish, where a $20,000 reward is being offered for information leading to the arrest of whoever shot and killed this dolphin.
I was tempted to discuss this as a purveyor of facts that you didn't know you needed until you heard them. I'm a sort of Prometheus of weird news items. And I wondered, as you may have too, had I mentioned it, who'd kill a dolphin? What's the message there? That the dolphin sleeps with the fishes? We already knew that. Why shoot a dolphin? Was a pigeon stuck in his blowhole as a warning to other dolphins? In case you know, flipper flips. But I decided no. Though there were jokes to be told, like certain inhumanely sourced tuna, that would be in bad taste. Even discussing dead dolphin jokes in a sort of meta context a few days after the fact to make a different point probably would not be that smart, though newly unearthed evidence reveals it is the sort of thing I would try to get away with once more in the service of making a different point. And here now is that point. Kristi Noem, supposedly skilled politician, why did you tell us about killing that puppy? This is a slightly different question from Kristi Noem, why'd you kill that puppy? And the answer to that is because Kristi Noem's a demoness. No, unfair. It's because she happens to be far crueler than anyone you or I would be comfortable sharing a long or medium car trip with. But why did Kristi Noem go public with it in such a miscalculated way? When she shared the anecdote on the South Dakota VFW circuit, did everyone in the room laugh and congratulate her? When her editor read it, and her family read it, and everyone she thanks in the credits of her book read it, did they say, "You, Kristi, you, good job, you are well on your way to earning the nascent serial killer vote"? It is baffling. More of a mystery even than the Jimmy Hoffa of porpoises over there in Louisiana. And what we don't need, what we certainly don't need to guide us through this horrific example of human behavior and misjudgment are the experts, but we've got experts. CNN had one.
Well, joining us now is dog trainer Zach George, host of Zach George's Dog Training Revolution.
And I have to say,
I'll save you the time. He was against assassinating dogs. Here's Mark Goldberg, dog trainer and co-author of several books written with the monks of New Skeet.
I have one thing to say to Governor Kristi Noem. Shame on you. Shame on you. What kind of human being are you? What kind of person are you? What kind of message are you sending to the citizens of your state, South Dakota, by taking a puppy out back to the gravel pit and shooting your own dog?
Thank you, Mark. I defer to your expertise. You've convinced me. Kristi Noem should not have shot her dog and then bragged about it. I'm won over. You know, Kristi Noem calculates most of her public utterances with one thing in mind, to please Donald Trump. And she heard him saying all those weird dog idioms he says.
Throwing us out like we're dogs.
They sweated like dogs.
They folded like dogs.
They choked like dogs.
They were fired like dogs.
She lied like a dog.
Dropped them like a dog.
And I guess she thought she just heard her marching orders. You know, this gets really serious when Elise Stefanik and J.D. Vance starts rolling out social media pictures that show them snuggling with labradoodles. So I say RIP Kristi Noem's VIP chances, just as we say RIP Cricket. And also RIP Peck Peck, Flappy, Mr. Yule, and Colonel Doodle-Doo. Those are the chickens that Cricket ate. No one seems to remember them, do they? Maybe Kristi Noem has the anti-chicken vengeance angle as one last play in the playbook. On the show today, I've got a full show with an interesting thinker, a critic. Her name is Becca Rothfeld. She writes for the Washington Post, a contributing editor at the Boston Review. But those are just credentials. Her new book gets at her big idea, which is that other ideas are just way too small. In fact, the book is called All Things Are Too Small, Essays in Praise of Excess. Marie Kondo takes it on the chin. Mindfulness? Oh, Becca gives mindfulness the what for. Becca Rothfeld up next, making the case and doing so in broad strokes. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. It was from Becca Rothfeld's new book of essays in praise of excess, titled All Things Are Too Small, that I gleaned the following insights. One, perturbation is a small price to pay for the privilege of a point of view, and the unwieldy appurtenances of personhood are the final casualties. Appurtenances of personhood. I love appurtenances of personhood. Could have been the
Thank
title you
so
of
much.
It. Yes. Tell me about Becca. Welcome to The Gist. Becca Rothfeld is also the nonfiction book critic of The Washington Post. She's written for The New Yorker. She's a philosopher and critic. Think literally a background in each. Welcome. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me. And thanks so much for attending to the way that words sound. A lot of people don't do that. And I tried really hard to make my book sound good. So I appreciate that.
Is there a rhythm of appurtenances to personhood? I mean, you could have gone with
accoutrements. I could have gone with accoutrements
to personhood, yes. Right?
But I didn't because I liked the way that it sounded.
When you think about it, an appurtenance is something of an appurtenance for this type of writing and thinking.
It is indeed.
Where do you ever stop and say, okay, this will lose the reader? Or do you say, this is a word as recognized in English, it is up to the reader to follow me there?
I think my overall philosophy as someone who writes for a public audience is that I hold them to high standards because I think that very few public intellectuals do. And I think that people rise to the standards that they're held to. So I think that my readers will learn new words if they don't know them by reading my stuff. But I just assume that my readers are intelligent.
Yeah, I've always been exactly in that camp. It's maybe a little different when talking on the radio or for podcasting. Certain words maybe strung together in a row would be a little discomforting to some readers. And you do want to meet the audience where they are. But as a reader, I loved coming across a word that I didn't know. What I didn't love is the bastardization, the molding of a word sometimes from a noun form into a verb form when a very fine and perfect verb would have sufficed. That often seems jargony to me.
Yeah, I don't love when people do that. I mean, I don't love like problematization. I mean, in fact, in the book, there's one essay where I take someone else to task for, she uses the word mainstreaming, the mainstreaming of things,
yes.
By which she means the process whereby things become mainstream. And I hated that. I took her to task for it.
Well, I believe that was Christina Emba, was it not?
Yes, it was.
Vanilla was out. Extremes were to be expected. Kinky sex is now the norm that choking has been mainstreamed. And you're right, this locution is Emba's strangulation of language, not mine. Clever, right? With the choking. But I was going to ask you, I had a whole bunch of questions to ask you about the Christina Emba essay, because she was on this show and she was talking about her book, Rethinking Sex, A Provocation. And there is the text of the criticism. But then there is the dynamic of, you are both opinion writers at the Washington Post. How do you navigate that? Because you really do fillet her without her consent.
Well, luckily for me, she actually just left the Washington Post and she's at the Atlantic now.
Did not know that.
But I do know her because she's in a bunch of my friend's circles. Like, there's not that many, I guess. Well, I don't want to say that about DC in a public forum. There are many intelligent and intellectual people in DC. However, people who think about things other than politics in DC are rare. So right. I encounter her a lot. I wrote the essay before I had ever met her and before I moved to DC. So I showed it to her. She asked me to coffee and I was like, before we go to coffee, you should know. I wrote this essay. It's not out yet. It's in my book. She read it and she was really gracious about it. She was like, friends can disagree. And so we proceeded from there.
I think that's fantastic on a couple of levels. One of them just being her point that friends could disagree. The other one is, you know, I had this conception of her as a pretty open person who enjoys engaging in debate, or at least doesn't shy away from it. And so you've confirmed that. That's pretty good. And then the third one is, I think that shows good manners to approach it the way that you did. I don't know. Were you very nervous before the lunch?
I was very nervous. I mean, I've never had that situation before, because usually when you write a really negative piece about someone's book, it comes out quickly. It comes out pretty immediately. But I had been sitting on this piece for a year because it's in a book. It's not just about Christine Emba's book. It's about a bunch of books that are kind of against the sexual revolution. But I do focus on her book and one other to make this broader point. And so I had been sitting on this for a really long time. So I'd never been in a position where I had written a very negative review of someone and they didn't know. And it was the first time I ever had to deal with that. And I was like, I guess honesty is the best policy.
What about each of you do you think helped navigate that moment? I mean, there's another world in which two people of a similar social milieu and at least age, and I know you're of, well, different religions and different backgrounds and different races, but there's a lot of similarities there. You know, you all went to the top schools and worked at the Washington Post. So I can imagine a situation where it doesn't work out like this. And I can imagine a situation where it does. I don't have to. You told me about that situation. So does it come down to just qualities of personality, or does it come down to, do you think, as much as you could speak to her, each of you believing in or subscribing into some sort of ideals or virtues about the way a person should interact with even ideals they might object to find or find odious?
I do think that both of us are committed to debate and kind of ideological collision. I think that both of us think that's healthy. We disagree about many things, not just things in the essay. We disagree about gender. We actually had a debate at the Aspen Institute about gender, because she wrote this long piece about gender with which I strenuously disagreed. And that was really fun. So I think that probably we're both a bit committed to that. I think we're also forced by our social circumstances to get over our personal disagreements, because we see each other all the time.
Yeah. No, just I'm trying to draw some lessons and figure out if there's one or two habits of mind, or what do they call them, on listicles, one special trick to navigate those situations. Because I've tried to, and I find it's getting harder in public life.
I mean, I think that if the other person is not willing to engage in disagreement with you respectfully, there's not that much that you can do about it.
That's true. Sorry to interrupt, but my situation, thanks for being my therapist in this part, by the way.
I love it.
But my situation is more like, yeah, we both have... maybe we have some social overlap and we both know that it's right to be committed to, say, the idea of dialogue. But then the rocky shoals of the specifics are just too much to navigate through. Or if I had to put my finger on it, it's more like we each have different publics that we have to be true to. And it does kind of get in the way. And we could each navigate, like she could navigate in her, I guess, Atlantic-y, Christian, I question the excesses of feminism, but I'm a liberal intellectual world, and you in your, I don't know, however you want to describe your world, but it's not exactly that. So what I'm saying is it's more of a tribal thing that gets in the way than anything else.
Yeah, I think a bit. I mean, I think that public discourse is different than personal friendship. So I think I'm really committed to engaging in public discourse with people that I disagree with, because I think that's healthy for the intellectual climate. And I think that that's just it's a good practice. It's a good way of understanding ideas. But it might be that somebody's beliefs, this isn't the case with Christine Emba, but it might be that someone's beliefs are so noxious that you think that they can't respect you as a person. And so you don't think that they could be friends with you. I still think that you should engage with them in a public forum if you can, because I still think it's instructive to demonstrate why you think their arguments are wrong.
Yeah, but then again, if you're engaging them in a public forum, it does kind of imply that someone is either paying you for it or giving you some sort of capital. You know, you gain some sort of capital by acting that way in public. It's less, it might seem to the outsider that it's harder to put on the public face, but in fact, in some ways, it's easier. There are a lot of incentives where people, you know, clap you on the back and thank you for doing that. Whereas if it's just an exchange over text or you turning to your partner saying, "Could you believe this person?" there are a lot less of the incentives of the public forum.
Although I think that people in my world, often the philosophy is that you should deplatform people.
I know. Like
you should try to prevent people who have really bad, evil views from speaking about those views. I tend to agree that a lot of the people that my friends think should be deplatformed have terrible views. I just think that, first of all, we can't deplatform them because we live in a free society and they have access to platforms. And second of all, that it's better for people to see that their arguments don't make sense, and that can only be accomplished via debate.
Those are two arguments that are actually a little bit at odds, right? One is it's impractical, and the other one is it's unethical slash it will counteract our intended goal. Those aren't exactly the same things.
No, they're not the same, but I don't think they're contradictory. I think they're just two separate reasons why you should engage someone you disagree with in debate if possible.
So I want to, well, here we are. I talked in depth about, well, we started by talking about a word that Christina Emba uses, and we got onto the Christina Emba thing, but we never really discussed what your point is with your critique of her essay, which essentially argues some sex is bad sex, right? Tries to anathemize some sexual practices. And could you tell me what your critique was and then how it fits into your overall thesis here about things being too small?
Yes. So I also think some sex is bad sex. The general point of this essay is that there's a lot of people, and Christine Emba is one of them, who think that consent is a necessary but insufficient condition for good sex. And that seems to me to be completely unobjectionably true. It seems clear enough that even if you consent to a sexual encounter, more is required for it to be both ethically good and pleasurable. But I think that there's two camps of people who have tried to articulate what good sex is like beyond consent. Some people on the left, who include the philosopher Amiya Srinivasan, and then some people more on the right. I don't know if Christine considers herself on the right, but I think her views about sexual politics are kind of on the right. She thinks the sexual revolution kind of went too far and that promiscuity is not making women happy. So my critique of her position is that I think that she and other critics of the sexual revolution instrumentalize sex. They think that sex is a means to the end of something beyond sex. And that's also true of people on the left. They just think it's a means to the end of something else. So I think people on the right tend to think sex is a means to the end of procreation, or Christine thinks that sex is a means to the end of expressing love. And people on the left tend to think that sex is, not all of them, obviously, not everyone on the right, not everyone on the left, but the people that I talk about in the book. Some people on the left think sex is a means to the end of expressing political commitments, whereas I think that sex is a pleasure and a joy in its own right, and that sex should be about recognizing the individuality of another person and allowing them to shock you. So another disagreement between me and Christine Emba, but also me and some people on the left, even though I consider myself on the left, is that I think a lot of people think that sex should be very safe and predictable. It should be norm governed so that nothing about it is uncomfortable or surprising to you at all. Whereas my view in this book is that, in fact, the best sex, both ethically and experientially, is sex that surprises you and maybe even transforms you a little bit.
So one of the thrusts of your complaint about what Emba was doing is she's essentially concocting a straw man or woman who argues that we were told all you need is consent. And you're essentially saying, I mean, were we told that? I don't know that we were told that. Maybe you were told that and have overinterpreted it. But who would possibly think that? So that's one of the premises, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think that there is this, a lot of people on the right have this phantom that they argue with all the time, the so-called liberal feminist. Obviously, there are people who identify as liberal feminists, but the way that people on the right understand liberal feminism is that anything that you choose is good because you choose it. I don't know a single person. I mean, I did not finish my PhD in philosophy at Harvard because I left to take a job at the Washington Post, but I spent 7 years at Harvard in my philosophy PhD. I never encountered a single person in the literature on liberalism or feminism who thinks that anything you choose is good because you've chosen it. That is not a position anyone holds.
So another thing about the EMBA essay and how it fits into, I know the subtitle is In Praise of Excess. So you're not saying that just sexual pleasure and gratification is an excess. You wouldn't define it as that. But it is an important thing, pleasure for pleasure's sake, and not some, it doesn't have to be used for some extra meaning that a lot of and in this case, there is a lot of literature where a lot of liberal progressive people analyze sex in that way.
Yeah, I think the connection with excess is that I understand excess not just as a matter of having a lot of things, but as a matter of having gratuitous things, like having more than you need. And I think that having more than you need in many domains is what humanizes us. And that's what I argue in the book in like various contexts. And so I think in the context of sex, if you just see sex as a necessary means to the end of something that you need for survival, like a means to the end of procreation, it's no longer this beautiful gratuity. It's no longer something that you do because you want to do it or because you honor the other person with whom you're doing it. It's something that you have to do. It's almost a chore. And that's the connection between a lot of things I talk about in the book. Like, I really love art, and my PhD was focused on aesthetics. And I think what is sort of distinctive about the aesthetic domain is that things that we appreciate because they are beautiful are not for anything else. They're not instrumental goods. They're intrinsic goods.
Is it important to have an excess, not just a surfeit, but an excess of things in the philosophy of, well, if your stockpile is plentiful, you'll never run dry or you'll never be wanting? Is that one of the reasons for the defense or, you know, your championing of excesses, or is it mostly something else? Excess in and of itself is the good thing.
Yeah, it's something else. I think it's not instrumental. I think that the argument throughout the book in various ways, because I defend different kinds of excess, is that different kinds of excess are what humanize us, that our humanity consists in having more than we need just to survive. So there's like an essay about Marie Kondo and decluttering where I say, not that you should just go out and buy a ton of stuff, but that having entanglements and encumberments and keeping old heirlooms and old love letters and old birthday cards and so on is what humanizes us. Having a past is what humanizes us, and having relationships with other people is what humanizes us. That's like one way I get to it. Or there's an essay about mindfulness where I say that I argue that mindfulness exhorts us to kind of empty our minds of thoughts and obsessions, and that having thoughts and obsessions is what makes us who we are. And so like that's what's good about it. It's not that it's good for some further end. It's good because it makes us human.
Let's go back for a second, because I'm sure the listeners are going to say, whoa, sex has to be surprising. Okay, that's great if it works out great for both people. But, and here's my question to you, if we had to, there are perhaps a couple different kinds of people in the world who weigh different virtues differently. And if one of your virtues is that no one should experience sexual violation, you would probably not subscribe to that sex should be surprising edict. But if your virtue is more that sex should be gratifying and fulfilling, maybe you then do risk the greater possibility of violative sex? Or do you think I'm constructing some sort of false paradigm here?
I don't think you're constructing a false paradigm, but I think that I sort of bite the bullet on this and have the unpopular opinion, which is that there isn't a way, not, there's two different arguments. One is that there's no way to make sex or love emotionally riskless. In fact, I take issue with, there's one conservative columnist, David French, I think, although I always confuse him with David Frum, who is very similar and has almost exactly the same
name.
One
is Canadian and one is from Tennessee. So no, you're right. It's David French. He's the Christian. Frum's the Jew. Keep going.
Right. Okay. David French, he has some quote where he was like, basically like, I don't remember the exact wording, but it's something like, we should try to make sex so that there's no danger to human hearts. And I just don't think that that's possible. I mean, I don't think that this means that everybody should be engaging in insane BDSM or something like that. I just think that if you are going to allow yourself to love other people, that has to involve allowing yourself to be surprised by them, because that's what is involved in encountering somebody who isn't you, is encountering someone who's to some extent unpredictable and who might transform or change you. And so there's just no way to alleviate some kernel of risk from any encounter worth having.
His quote is, sex without love is a danger to human hearts, to which you essentially say something between, well, okay, or good.
But both, like, good and also, like, everything is a danger to human hearts. Like, any, you know, friendship can hurt you. You get a dog, it's going to die. Like, that's part of existing.
And we'll be back with Becca Rothfeld after the break. And we're back with Becca Rothfeld. And the Marie Kondo stuff is, it's just delicious. You did not spare her. Now, the critique of Marie Kondo, she is open to critique. She is ripe for critique. And you used every scalpel, lance, saber, battle axe. So you didn't declutter your sharp weapon arsenal.
No, I have so many weapons. I love them.
So what, that's right. We open the cabinet and there you are with a virtual armory all aimed at poor Marie Kondo. But what do you think her popularity says about us and our anxiety?
Yeah. I mean, I think that people have a superficial desire, which I also have, to just lead simple lives that are devoid of complexity. I read for research for the book, like many, like maybe 20 or something, like books about decluttering, like not just Marie Kondo's. And there's a ton of them and they all sell really well. And another thing that people always say is that it's good to not have any belongings because then you could move anywhere at any time. So I think that there's this contemporary vision that like a desirable life would be to not really have roots in any one place and to have maximal freedom where you can just travel anywhere, anytime, and your job is mobile, it's digital. I think that that's a superficially appealing vision because that is like a superficially appealing kind of freedom to have. But I think ultimately is quite unsatisfying because I think that people don't want, why would you want to be able to travel anywhere at any time as opposed to having your home in one place where you have friends and connections and commitments?
Right. And this at a time when the U.S., it's an irony. I think it qualifies as an irony where we're living in the lowest internal migration rate time in U.S. history. So as we stop actually engaging in the behavior of picking up and moving, we're valorizing the possibility of this behavior. I don't know. I think it probably ties into some valorization of the American West or gun culture or rugged individualism as we actually lose the individualism more and more. I mean, most of us, you read The Grapes of Wrath, like having to move is not a great thing to be thrust upon.
No, people want to, and I mean, I'm a Jew whose ancestors come from like the Polish shtetl or whatever, you know, like we've lost our homeland and that is bad. People want to, we should want, and we need to have history and a tradition. So I think it is a very American fantasy, which is also something that I talk about in the book, the American fetishization of simplicity, which I think has particular origins on the East Coast and sort of the Puritan tradition. But you're totally right that there's also something very American about this idea that you could just pick up with nothing and go anywhere and start over completely. And that might be why Marie Kondo's books, they do really well in America, but they don't do well in Japan. That's an interesting fact. So that could be why. And then she moved to America. She's like, her whole career is here now because Americans love her.
Yeah, she's like the reverse Spinal Tap. They went to like Sex Farm went to number 5 in Japan and didn't really gain much purchase here. Anyway, do you think you as a book person specifically, do you think that plays into your critique of Marie Kondo? Like if you were a tech person and the things that were causing clutter were out of date, I don't know, computers or Macs or pieces of technology, might there be less hanging on to them and finding value in them?
Maybe, but I think that part of my argument is that everybody should have in their physical space, first of all, just pieces of art. Like, I think that art is something that is really under-discussed in these books. They kind of just assume that everything that you have in your house is some utilitarian object that you wouldn't lose anything by discarding. There's no place in their account for something that you just enjoy having. I mean, I guess sparking joy is Marie Kondo's thing, supposedly, but it ends up being very brutal. And art is something that is never discussed. But I also think another thing that it is good for people to have to some extent is reminders of their past, like mementos. And all of these people counsel that you can move on better from your past if you throw away love letters and birthday cards and whatever, like ticket stubs from the past, which I think everybody has those, even tech people. So my argument is, of course, not that you should just keep everything in your house. Like, obviously, sometimes you should throw things away, but that I don't think that you should strive to throw away as much as possible, or in particular to throw away hallmarks of your past.
Yeah, I also think she's maybe doing something insidious with the verb, the spark verb, spark joy. I mean, when we think about happiness, how much of happiness is just a rush of euphoria, a dopamine hit, right? She's essentially selling value as one would a drug dealer. Do you have this dopamine hit when you look at this item? I mean, contentedness is, I think, a better way to evaluate joy than the spark of joy, let's say. Contentedness, the feeling of the sublime that is more omnipresent in the background rather than a sudden rush. And I think it's probably, I don't know how that's translated from the Japanese, but I think it's probably intentional. And she's not fighting fair when she says that's the criteria.
Yeah. And I also think that there's values besides joy. Like there might be things that cause you pain that you should still keep.
Yes.
You know, like if you're
right. The value of nostalgia. Nostalgia literally meaning pain from the past. Honor that. Keep that around. Absolutely. Okay, so I want to now talk about mindfulness. Is mindfulness essentially the Marie Kondo or mindfulness discourse, which is about decluttering the mind? That literal word comes up a lot. Is what's going on there and the addressing of our anxiety there very similar to what's going on with our physical clutter?
Yeah, that's one of the arguments of the book. I think it's the one that will probably make the most people angry. But I did do due diligence. Like I read the top 20 or something like best-selling mindfulness books. I know that not everybody is as crazy as the people in the mindfulness books that I read, but I was trying to get a representative sample of, you know, the general forms of the ideology that are present. And I think I did a pretty good job. And it is pretty nuts. Like they really do want you to declutter your mind. That's a metaphor that comes up explicitly a couple times. There's even one book that's called Declutter Your Mind or something. And I think that that's not good at all. Like I think that your personhood consists in the clutter of your mind. That's who you are. It's your thoughts. It's your obsessions. That isn't, of course, to say that you should just accept every negative emotion you have or that you should give into anxiety. But it is to say that the end goal should not be to reduce your mind to a state of non-judgmental awareness, which is the thing that that's the term of art that many of the mindfulness people use. When you're engaging in mindfulness, they say you're engaging in non-judgmental awareness. You're not having thoughts. You're not making judgments. You're not experiencing emotions. Or like if those things arise, you kind of just let them flow away while you continue to have non-judgmental awareness, whatever that even is.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the, or I guess it's a pair of authors, William and Penman, say that mindfulness provides respite from the thought stream that ordinarily drags us along kicking and screaming. And as you say, well, I enjoy my thoughts. I enjoy following my thoughts. There's a great pleasure and just taking pleasure in listening to my thoughts and following where they go. Now, there are sometimes you get into a rumination cycle, or there's, I guess, the Buddhist idea of the monkey mind, and you can't shut it off, and your mind is bothering you more than it's helping you. I guess the trick is to discern between those two states. Do you have any advice for us about how to do that?
I don't know that I have great advice, but as somebody who does have like clinical anxiety, it does seem to me pretty obvious when you're having useless thoughts that almost don't seem like they are reflective of you versus when you're having genuine perturbation because you don't understand something that you want to understand, which is like a profitable state. And, you know, if you're like, I don't understand mortality, that's something that you should sit with and you should think through it. As opposed to if you're just like, I'm going to die in a plane crash. like, no, you're not going to die in a plane crash. And I do say explicitly in the book that I don't think it would be harmful to engage in short periods of mindfulness when you're sort of in the midst of a panic attack or something. But these books all advise you to try to bring mindfulness to bear on as much of your life as possible, which is the part that I object to, because I think that that's a recipe for a very impoverished existence.
And as we all know, perturbation is a small price to pay for the privilege of a point of view. Very wise,
exactly.
Very wise person told us that at one point. Yes, I definitely agree. I definitely enjoy my thoughts. I am not tortured by my thoughts. I have had moments like the rest of humanity, I guess maybe the rest of non-sociopathic humanity, who has had those excessive ruminations. I wouldn't jettison the possibility of an insight. And if the trade-off were, I'd have all these moments of thoughtlessness, supposed bliss. For me, I don't see why the trade-off works. So many really smart people and really grounded people, or often people who seek grounding, swear by it in a way that I think, unlike the Marie Kondo stuff, the best I could think about the mindfulness community is it doesn't seem like it's for me, but it does seem to be, not in the caricatured form, but if it's done with discretion, it does seem, I would have to say that it does seem to work for a lot of people. Do you think that's true? Do you think it works for people other than you?
I mean, I think that having brief periods of mindfulness works even for me, but it's the idea that the state that you're in when you're mindful is the sort of desirable state for you to be in as much as possible, or represents like a higher state of being. I think that that's not true for anybody. I mean, I think that, like, I understand you want to take a break. You want to take a break from your personality and you want to take a break from your intellect for 30 minutes a day. That seems fine and understandable. My mechanism for that is watching terrible reality TV. Yours is mindfulness. Fine. But I think that as a vision for what humanity should be like, I think that it's impoverished. Although I would not tell anybody like not to meditate sometimes. I would say that you shouldn't experience your thoughts or your mental life as embarrassment.
Right. You're not breaking through someone's door who's meditating saying, I'm here to extract you from this. Here, take these seven things, including mementos from your grandmother and a piece of art. This is my prescription for you. No.
I'm like, meditate for 30 minutes or whatever, but then stop meditating.
Or even better yet, here, take this 300-something page book called All Things Are Too Small, Essays in Praise of Excess. This is my prescription for you.
It is. This is my prescription for the thoughtless.
Becca Rothfeld, author of said book. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. This was so fun.
And that's it for today's show. As we say the names of everyone on the production staff, I want you to just think of a picture of a South Dakota chicken with a candle burning bright to remember what cricket wrought. Corey Wara, he's there with Flap Flap, in the arms of an angel. Joel's the senior producer and the one who keeps our wonderful chickens in his heart. Michelle Pesca, she's there. We've ghosted that haunting photo of Sir Beaks a lot. Let us never forget Beaksy. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. A portion of all our proceeds will go to the ex-cricket chicken rehabilitation fund. Go to advertisecast.com/thegist to advertise with us. We'll give a little to those chickens. Ooperoo-jeeperoo-dooperoo. And thanks for listening.